From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Without John Portman, you would not walk into a hotel lobby with a cavernous atrium, an office tower with stacked balconies, or a shopping center with transparent elevators whizzing up and down. John Portman revolutionized architecture, turning buildings inward to jaw-dropping effect. Take it from his friend, Andrew Young.
Everybody became a country bumpkin when they walked into the Hyatt. You had to say, oh my God, what is this?
Highly influential and often imitated, Portman was also a developer, and his Peachtree Center, Marriott Marquis, Hyatt Regency, which Andrew mentioned, and other megastructures brought new life to Atlanta's crumbling urban center. Portman died just over a year ago at the age of 93, and Mohsin Mustafavi is editor of Portman's America and Other Speculations. It's a book that explores the architect's imprint on cityscapes around the world. Mohsin is also dean of the Harvard Graduate School of Design and joins me on the line from Harvard. Mohsin, welcome.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Virginia.
Good morning to you. I walked around and really did the Portman tour yesterday, and it is so difficult to imagine Atlanta without these huge structures clustered downtown. How groundbreaking were those first developments?
They were really unusual because, you know, up until that time, when you think about cities and their developments, they're mainly made up of high streets. And the development of most cities had been fairly gradual. And for John to really imagine such a large-scale development, of course it was a little bit organic, but nevertheless, I think the scale of it was something pretty astonishing, and it was very much transformative.
Now, his work really began to flourish in the late 1960s with the what was then called Merchandise Mart, now America's Mart, and Peachtree Center. This is a time when city centers were in decline, and he said he wanted to draw people back in. In your words, these large-scale projects redefined the relationship of architecture to the city and its citizens. How so?
Well, partly in cities like Atlanta during this period, you see a great deal of flight, if you like, from the city to the suburbs. And that's something that actually in most places is still continuing. So trying to bring people back to the city meant that he had to really think in a different way. And the whole concept of designing a series of buildings interconnected with each other, where a great lot of activities could happen on the inside, which had a whole host of benefits in terms of protection from the weather, proximity of various functions to each other, and also the way in which people from different types of background or work could also interact on the inside of the buildings, at the same time have restaurants and shops and essentially be within a kind of, you know, defined, protected environment. I think that was something that was very unusual at that time.
And an environment that really took into account sound and movement and how people relate to each other. Now, in Atlanta, John Portman designed a number of iconic structures. Peachtree Center, we mentioned, the Marriott Marquis, Hyatt Regency, and made the Westin Peachtree Plaza Hotel, perhaps best known for its rotating rooftop restaurant. So could you, using any of these examples, help explain how they redefined Atlanta?
I think first we have to look at the way in which these buildings really dealt with the inside of architecture. Previously, when you entered a hotel, you would enter a lobby, and then from the lobby take the elevator to your room. So essentially the only public space of the building was the lobby. John Portman really tried to turn the whole hotel experience into a spectacle. And for the people who visited the hotels, it was you know, something very unusual, where they could basically see from the ground floor all the floors of the hotel. People who traveled through the elevators, as you mentioned, could then be part of that spectacle and look down from their room floors to the lobby. And so this idea of the architecture as a kind of spectacle was an important part of creating an environment that contributed to the enhancement, if you like, of the quality of life or the kind of feeling that the architecture at that time produced. We can talk, of course, about some of the specific examples that you mentioned, like the Hyatt Regency. It was unusual at that time to combine these terraces with planting to introduce art into the building, and that was something that he did himself too by creating incredible sculptures. So he was really into a kind of incredible architecture of spectacle.
Yeah, and it is really is jaw-dropping to walk into these places. Let's hear from him. He's talking about his concept of thinking of things holistically.
You have to think of it holistically. And holistically as a living thing, not just as a mechanical thing or a technological thing. I am more interested in people than I am things.
I love this concept of taking all of the things that were previously hidden and exposing them and creating what he called a soft center, the soft center in a building. But that point that he's more interested in people than in things, how would you describe his philosophy and how that was communicated, that interest in the human aspect?
Actually, when you talk to John, that was something that was always at the forefront of his thoughts and ideas, the way his buildings were used and the impact that they had on their users. Most people, when they think about John Portman's architecture, they're really thinking about the formal qualities and the formal aspects of his work. But to him, what really mattered, and the thing that he emphasized every single time, was if he was looking at the work of some other architect, is really how it was going to be used by people. That was something that he always thought about from the beginning, and I think that was essentially part of his success. He said that he didn't really take risks because what he did was he found out about the way things worked, and he had so much he had invested so much knowledge in trying to learn that essentially he wasn't taking much of a risk. For the rest of us, I think his projects at that time were quite risky in a way.
To me, but, yes, I would imagine.
Yeah, but he felt that he had made so much investigation that he safeguarded against any risk. And that's basically this idea of learning how buildings work with people and understanding the function of things incredibly deeply.
Yeah, I love, there's a description that he was asked by the New York Times in 2011 why he designed these theatrical lobbies and said, you want to spark people's enthusiasm. Riding in a glass elevator, everyone talks on a glass elevator. You get into a closed door elevator, everyone looks down at their shoes. So it's a kind of exchange of the human spirit that we're talking about in the work of John Portman with Harvard Graduate School of Design Dean Mohsen Mustafavi. He's editor of Portman's America and Other Speculations. It's a book considering the impact of his work and loads of beautiful photographs of his work. But it seems that, by your own description, John Portman was one of the most creative, controversial, daring, and prolific architects. What made his work so controversial?
Well, the fact that he was daring, of course, you know, to be daring, that means that you have to try new things. And always when you create new things, that also creates a certain level of unexpected reactions. But I think when he started, as you know, he was very, very much interested in the intersection between architecture and development. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that actually was frowned upon in many circles. Because it was thought that, you know, architects have to focus on doing architecture and developers focus on doing development. And for an architect on development projects, sometimes you might end up with these kind of conflictual relationships. But in fact, for John, if anything, this was the opposite. Development allowed him to do or to engage with a kind of architecture that he couldn't have engaged with otherwise. He was doing houses, and he was very critical of doing small-scale projects. So engaging in development actually meant that he could then invest and participate in much larger scale projects than he would have been. And the other thing is that he did these things when he was incredibly young.
Mm-hmm.
That's also very important, the way in which he learned from his parents, specifically from his mother, to go and borrow money and then, you know, pay the money back and borrow again, and to really kind of try and learn about establishing a kind of credit history from his mother at that time, which is also incredibly wise in some ways for someone who wants to engage in this kind of large-scale development.
Yeah, his mother, a woman who didn't even graduate high school, but he considered to be brilliant. But a little bit on that beginning, he started his practice, I think, in 1953, and reflects upon, you know, working on houses so hard that he probably made 31 cents an hour. So,
that's right.
So the motivation to become a developer was great, but that's a big criticism that, you know, he could greenlight basically these huge projects that other people would have to go through, other architects would have to go through many, many steps to get there. So what did that mean for not just buildings, but realizing or reimagining a whole cityscape? Is it good, Moisen, to have that much power, I guess, is the question.
I don't know that architects who work with other developers, have a different kind of power. In a sense, that power is invested in developers. I mean, what's unusual about John is that he brings development and architecture together, whereas other architects have to go through the work of developers. So essentially, that kind of rethinking of that combination is an important thing to bear in mind. But I think it certainly has advantages in that it enables you to think about a conglomeration of buildings. Most other architects are really hired to do often one building at a time. And to be able to work in a sense with an ensemble, with a series, with a grouping of buildings, does mean that you can work on the interrelationship between architecture and urbanization, or architecture and the city, in a way that when you have a single commission, it's much harder to think about that impact. But you're also right that it raises certain issues in terms of the vision of one individual or the vision of one practice and its impact on a larger territory. But these things are also topics that then we have other systems in terms of systems of review, the review of planning procedures and things like that, to address some of the topics related to power structures that you are raising.
Well, there are plenty of people in Atlanta who did not love his work. There are many who mm-hmm. absolutely, absolutely love it. But one of the real precise criticism is that he turned urban street life into this away from the street. You know, he put mm-hmm. all of that kind of, you know, as you say, the hanging ferns and these kind of cavernous oases inside of buildings, not encouraging people to go out. You were his friend. What would he say to those criticisms?
Well, I think that partly that kind of criticism is probably fair and true. At the same time, when you are trying to do what he was doing at that time in the 60s, and really finding a situation where the streets were no longer functioning as a dynamic environment, bringing different parts of sectors of the community together, then this idea of the internalization was really one way to respond to that kind of question. I think now, this is also something like 50 or almost 60 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the question is, what can we learn from these projects? The other thing is, you know, we shouldn't forget that this type of project has a longer history. The idea of the arcades that we see in many European cities, or the arcades in places like Paris or in Spain, they are also the precursors of this notion of a kind of internalization, connecting the street through the mall. And then, of course, the whole sort of development of the mall since then is a continuation of this idea of the interior. It goes without saying that it has pros and cons, and I think when you have these air conditioned spaces, there is some level of comfort and some level of pleasure and some level of ease. At the same time, it's also true that the internalization of architecture does take away life from the streets. So the question is whether there could be, for example, transformations in the future where, learning from these experiences, we could actually transform these projects as time goes on, because I think this is also part of an important learning experience. And mm-hmm. I think these projects have a future, which would be interesting to sort of think about them, how they might sustain themselves in the next 40 or 50 years to come.
We certainly want to keep you with us, but we're heading into a break so quickly. The Dutch architect Rem Koolhaas said, "Atlantis is a convulsive architecture that will eventually acquire beauty." How do you think they've aged?
I think that they have actually aged very, very well. Many times when I entered John's buildings or I went to see him at the office, I was surprised by how brand new the interiors of many of the buildings looked. And I thought, well, have you been doing maintenance on these buildings in the last year or so? And the answer was, no, we did this work like 3, 4, 5 years ago. So I think the buildings have aged very, very well. And the convulsive beauty in some ways that's implied in the work is definitely something that we should think about for the future in an exciting way.
Mohsen Mustafavi is going to stay with us. He's editor of the new book, Portman's America and Other Speculations. And we're going to continue our conversation about the architect John Portman, who transformed Atlanta and many other major cities. I'm Virginia Prescott. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. As a young architect and Georgia Tech graduate in the 1960s, Atlanta native John Portman took out a $100 loan to open his first office, beginning a career that would transform the American city and influence design on a global scale. He died in December of 2017 at the age of 93. And we're talking about a book that looks at his legacy with Mohsen Mustafavi. He's editor of Portman's America and Other Speculations. He's also dean of Harvard's Graduate School of Design. We were speaking earlier before the break about the power of being a developer. There were some criticisms about that, but one of the things that it did allow is a kind of will to do what he wanted with buildings. And in fact, when he opened one of his earliest buildings, a million square foot America's Mart is now called. Prior to its opening, he decided the two restaurants at the Mart would be Atlanta's first integrated eateries. Now, this family's prepared obituary says he made no big to-do about this, and the restaurants quietly flourished. Also made the Hyatt Regency Atlanta's first integrated hotel. So what were the reactions to that at the time, Mohsen?
I think they were very positive. I think in the book you can read how excited John was when he heard that the vote had been cast and it was going to be possible for restaurants to be desegregated. You also had earlier on Mae Young, who was a very close friend of John's. I think that it's really important to recognize that from the very beginning, John was so dedicated to the idea of the city as a melting pot, as an integrated space, and really trying to welcome people of all backgrounds into his architecture. And this is also something that's reflected in what you were referring to earlier on, which is his love of the user, of the people, mm-hmm. and really thinking about the way in which architecture could respond to the needs and the desires of the user.
Yeah, he sounded like a real watcher of people. He'd sit around in hotel lobbies himself, and that was one of the things that gave him an idea. But I'd love to dwell into the personality a little bit. In fact, he says to his children, or there's a transcript of a terrific interview at the conversation at the beginning with two architects and a builder who'd worked with him for ages. And he said, you know, he was not the starchitect. He said, Dad's too busy for a personality. But he was asked, where did you get this ability to see these things? And he said, it just showed up. What was that, Moisen? Was that humility? Was that just a kind of certainty that he had about himself?
I think that the interview or the conversation that you're referring to is actually wonderful, and it involves two friends and colleagues, Max Goggin and Mary Elam, as well as Mickey Steinberg, who was a close collaborator of John's. I think he was very curious, and the combination of curiosity and ambition probably was an incredibly powerful ingredient in a way for his architecture. To be curious meant that he was following his hunches about what could happen. Of course, we all need also a little bit of luck, and I think the beginning of his career starts with this instance of getting advice from his father, and then coming across some really wonderful people who helped him. But that was also very much linked to him being so enthusiastic and so interested and so committed. And at the same time, not giving up. We see instance after instance of this when he's in the Navy and then he's asked to box. And then he's really thrown into the ring with the champion boxer, and who really manages to teach him a lesson about boxing.
He didn't as an throw amateur, a single so. He didn't throw a single punch at the other at his opponent, if I remember correctly.
Exactly. And I think those things are a testament to his willingness to really participate and not to give up. There's also the other instance of the story from his mother where she says, you know, if something happens to you or if there's a disaster, don't give up, just keep moving on. Mm-hmm. And I think don't focus on bad things. I think this is very, you know, these are really incredible lessons in life. And I think you could very much sense that being with him and seeing his interactions with other people. He was always amazingly generous.
Well, we've talked about Atlanta primarily, but the Embarcadero in San Francisco, the Marriott in New York City. He built skylines of Shanghai, Kuala Lumpur, Warsaw, Mumbai. It's just an incredible legacy. But in addition to these speculations, your book contains beautiful images by the photographer Ewan Bonn. What do you want readers to see when they look at these photos? And for people who see Portman's creations in person, how will they see them differently?
Right. Often when you see books on contemporary architects, these may be referred to as coffee table books because they are used in order to promote the architect, essentially. In this particular book, I really wanted to make sure that the audience, the reader, saw the city for what it was. And I think there's also reference to this idea of how important it is for us to experience cities as they are. And I refer to the idea of sort of looking at the city through these photographs as if in a state of distraction. And by that, I mean that they are not typical architectural photographs where they're trying to really do frontal views of parts of the architecture, very formal images, but they are as if in passing you experience the building. It's the kind of image that you might recollect if you've been to, let's say, the Hyatt Regency or the Marriott Marquis, and you try to imagine what it was like. These images are catching people a little bit off guard. Of course, they're also capturing beautiful qualities of the interior of the spaces as well as the exterior, but they're also capturing people by the pool in a way that they're not posing for the photograph. And I think these photographs are very important for people to sort of understand the buildings as they are rather than trying to beautify them in a way. And I think that that's part of the strength of Ewan's photography, that he's one of the best people in the world for taking photographs.
Mohsin, I'm sorry that I have to stop you there. We're up against the break, but I'm so appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Virginia. Bye-bye.